injected to Dr. Rosenthal's Chapel House for green care database. So, ladies and gentlemen, use the format, no Chapel House rules, it will be an open debate. Rosemary, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for making brief introductions. So, I won't do that. All that's left me is to wield this hammer, which His Royal Highness has kindly relinquished to me. I no regret it. Now, the deal is that we have some debates here. The issue is what boundaries to mediation in the Middle East, and there's plenty of room for contention in there. There are many conflicts to be mediated. They keep proliferating and expanding, and we have extremely erudite panel, starting with His Royal Highness Prince Hassan, who is very good at mediation but also debate, and he is going to set the tone with the first intervention. He and the other panelists have agreed that they will limit themselves to 8 minutes only for their first intervention. So this should be pretty exciting. Your Royal Highness.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I spoke at 8:30 this morning on Sky News on the beginning of their four-year review of the situation in Iraq. And I just want to replay some of their questions, because I start by talking about national mediation, then regional mediation, then international mediation. Firstly, the first question was, how has the region changed since the invasion? The terminology of Sky News. And I wanted to point out that as Hans Blix is today accusing the Prime Minister Blair of sin in defining the objectives of humanitarian intervention, the invasion, whatever you wish to call it, in terms of the nuclear issue. Hans Blix chairs the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, on which I serve. I would like to point out that if the issue of energy is really of concern, then nobody could be more concerned than my country, because we live in the middle of the danger zone. And it might be of interest to you to know that in September of last year, Sam Nunn, the chairman of our Nuclear Threat Initiative Group, participated in the signing. The NPI signed an agreement with the American Department of Energy on the one hand, with the Kazakhstan government on the other, to change HEU, highly enriched uranium, into LEU. More recently, Sam Nunn spoke at the IAEA. And in that context, I was happy to see that Mr. Baradei was in a position to welcome the idea of creating a fuel bank. And Warren Buffett, not to be introduced to this audience, contributed $50 million as startup capital for a fund for a fuel bank. I'm happy to see that North Korea has since taken a decision to begin to reverse its development of the ACU. And I would say to our Southeast Asian participants in this audience that I would be delighted to see an energy charter being produced by the ASEAN community. As far as Iraq is concerned, I assume that the threat of weapons of mass destruction is not what we're talking about today. What we're talking about today is the threat of internal combustion, ethnic and sectarian breakup. The invasion has promoted the profile of the Shia in Iraq, and by extension the Shia in Iran. The invasion has promoted the new reality of the Kurdish autonomy. If you recall, since the Treaty of Sèvres in 1920, the Kurds, like the Palestinians, have been hopeful of cultural self-determination, but you have an artificial situation today, a unique situation in the Kurdish area of relative peace, and you have an air base in that area referred to as Darang, which actually receives as much traffic, volume of traffic, as Heathrow Airport. So whether or not Darang is going to be relinquished by next year, is a question which brings me to the second point. Are the changes irreversible? And I would like to suggest in this context that the concept of supranationalism does not exist in our Near East West Asian region. You'll notice my definition of region, because on the Lugar Bison committee some years ago, they were talking about from Marrakesh to Bangladesh, from Casablanca to Calcutta, which is the poorest, the most dangerous, and the most populous region in the world. So let's try to talk about something remotely manageable. West Asia, or the Near East, takes in its stride the Greek-Turkish confrontation, it takes in its stride the Caspian consortium of pipelines, and it brings West Asia closer to Europe. Not the soft underbelly of NATO, hopefully, but a complementary zone of stability. In the Balkans, 450,000 soldiers entered to implement an agreement, and I think that is the difference between more and more soldiers entering Iraq and, let me remind you of the unprecedented naval power in the region, two carrier task forces, the German Navy in the Eastern Mediterranean, unprecedented in modern history. Presumably these navies are not going to fight in the back streets of Baghdad or to fight in the ravines of South Lebanon, but what they will do, I assume, is to prevent incoming ordnance. And I go back to the faux pas of Monsieur Chirac, if it was a faux pas indeed, that Tehran would be vaporized in the event of an attack. Of course, that's a bad news, good news story. It's a macabre joke in our part of the world that we all die, but we are going to be reassured that Tehran and possibly Islamabad will be removed from the face of the map in revenge for this outrageous act, but we won't be around to see it. As far as the Arab neighbors, have they intervened to improve the situation? I think that as far as the search for a regional solution, this has been a gleam in the eye for years and years. It's come and gone. We've seen regional solutions being proposed, most recently at the Mecca conference between Hamas and the PLO. Despite that, people have gone back to killing each other in the streets of Gaza and the West Bank. The Israeli army enters at will, and there is no protection regime as yet for minorities in our region. I would like to commend in that context the work of the Oxford Research Group, which talked in 2003 of the importance of a protectorate for the Palestinians, which I would take back to the Custodianship Council of 1949 and the United Nations Special Commission on Palestine. The fact is that two countries filled the vacuum, the State of Israel and the Kingdom of Jordan. Kingdom of Jordan for 17 years, and then the State of Israel for 40 years, from 67 to the present day. But that doesn't mean that the Palestinian people are forgotten. And I think it's tragic that as the Baker-Hamilton report was being produced, at one and the same time, Kevin Kennedy, the Administrator for Assistance, was asking for $450 million for existential aid for the Palestinians. What could still be done by the Arab states to improve the situation, or what might this require of the international community? You will notice a hybrid now of Islamic mediation and Arab mediation, and I think still an unresolved issue of whether the Arab summit will precede the Islamic summit, whether they'll be held back to back. I would think that if I were an Indonesian or a Malaysian or a Pakistani or a Turk, I would try to preserve the integrity of Arab diplomacy, obviously, but also the integrity of Asian diplomacy. The idea of bringing the outer periphery countries in is, of course, partly in response to the Israeli request that we can't make comprehensive peace with the Arabs. What about Iran? This was said in Cairo a few years ago, I recall, and I said to myself, well, yes, but who is Israel to move back the doorpost, as it were? If we're going to talk about peace in Asia, why can't we talk in terms of a conference for security and cooperation in the region, accepted by the parties? And in that sense, I do think that the coordinator for the discussion of the future of Iraq between the different parties in Iraq is essential. If state building is going to develop, it cannot develop on, against the background of fear, bigotry and hatred. It has to develop against the background of mercy, truth and justice. And I think the trust deficit has to be closed sometime this year in terms of an internal dialogue. The constitution exists, the TAL exists, the temporary authority law, but at the same time, what leverage does it have while foreign occupation continues? But on the other hand, is the security conference of yesterday not more than an attempt to say to Prime Minister Maliki, or an attempt by Prime Minister Maliki to invite the support of the regional countries for his security plan? And is the issue just sovereignty? City? Is it just the question of facing down the gun-toting extremists? Or is there a power-sharing arrangement, a wealth-sharing arrangement, a decentralization arrangement to be considered? And in terms of what comments I would make on the safety of the region after 4 years of U.S. occupation, I just say that in terms of demography, out of a total population of 26 million, some 1.8 million Iraqis are IDPs, while up to 2 million have fled to other countries. Up to 2.3 million, 1 in 10 Iraqis, could be internally displaced by the end of 2007. Since November 2006, the pace of refugee outflow is accelerating at a dramatic rate, with the number of those displaced jumping by 43%. My country has received 750,000, which would be the equivalent of 30 million arriving on the coast of the United States. This country, I think, has absorbed 200. So, in terms of human dignity, human security, I would stop here by saying that we simply have to acknowledge the need for national reconciliation efforts, the need for a convincing regional conference, which is not just a one-item agenda, security as it is perceived in Lebanon, Palestine, or Iraq being left to the security agencies and the military, or in Afghanistan for that matter. I think that internationally, as I said the other day in Berlin, the concept of a Berlin Congress might be one of the ways to get us out of this Westphalian reality, which is not one of our seeking. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. His Royal Highness Prince Hassan has to live in the eye of the storm and has to watch those who don't live in the heart of the region keep making mistakes, has forborne to mention that. But Michael Ancrum, who's recently visited the region, and they wrote the matter of Jerusalem, in fact, has a number of thoughts to convey about what he thinks the boundaries of mediation should be at the moment.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to follow Prince Hassan because his knowledge of the region and his analysis of the situation, I think, is always well worth listening to and certainly well worth learning from. And so I'm very grateful to him for what he said to us. I want to approach this from a slightly different angle. I've spent probably the last 15 years involved on the fringes of what you might call conflict resolution. I started not so much on the fringes in Northern Ireland. I then, as the Federalist One said, I became involved in talking to the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. I went to Saudi Arabia when the South-North conflict was on. And I came to a very clear conclusion that in all these areas of conflict, while military action can contain the conflict, it can never resolve it. And you know, in the Northern Ireland context, I'm always very careful of not using analogies because they're all different. But the reason we began to change our approach was when we realized two things. One is that for all our military efforts, we were never going to defeat the IRA. Equally, they were never going to defeat us. But also, that if we were looking for a solution, we could not do it by isolating the IRA because they had to be part of the solution. And that seems to me to be something which runs across all these different areas of conflict. Where if you go to the Middle East, I've said this publicly before, I cannot see an independent, viable Palestine which does not include Hamas, as Hamas is over half the popular vote in that country at the last election. I cannot see a peaceful Lebanon to the north of Israel which doesn't include Hezbollah, because Hezbollah is a major elected part of that country. I cannot see a stable Middle East without involving Syria, because Syria holds the key to so much of what is happening in that area and can happen in the future. So while, yes, military action will always take place to contain conflict, it can never be regarded as the solution. And because of that, I think it's absolutely vital when we talk about the boundaries of negotiation that we understand that dialogue is at the centre of eventually coming to a conclusion. I had a letter in the Times the other day, which one or two people criticised, but I ended it by saying that it is often a better use of time to talk to your enemies than your friends. I certainly believe that to be true. You don't solve anything by talking to your friends, but by talking to your enemies you can begin to slowly and gradually move things forward. And if I may start just with the Middle East, I know the reality of the situation. I don't believe there is going to be full-blooded negotiation in any real sense in the very near future. But there is another form of dialogue, and it's a form of dialogue which, when I was trying to develop the concept of it in the Northern Ireland context, we called exploratory dialogue. And exploratory dialogue is a very useful technique because it commits nobody to anything. You have the conversations in order to try and feel out and test out people's positions at the moment and how far possibly they might be prepared to go if there was a genuine negotiation process taking place. And because there is no commitment, that dialogue, I find, wherever I try to take part in it, is actually constructive. People feel that they can talk in safety because they're not having to put their case on the hook and can't get off it. And I do think that in the Middle East there is an enormous potential at this time for exploratory dialogue between various parties there. No commitment, but finding out how over a process they can begin to move towards each other. And one of the fascinating things I find about exploratory dialogue is the person who conducts it. Quite often you find that the farther, what I call the lines in the sand, actually overlap with each other. And you suddenly find there are areas where, with a bit of luck, you can get people onto the same territory. And the other thing about it is that you can carry it on while the military action is taking place. It doesn't have to have a ceasefire and take a peace before it can happen at the same time. And I do believe that there should be no boundaries to that type of dialogue, because I think that it can have a great use. If I can look at Iraq, and so much of what I was going to say has already been said by His Royal Highness, but what troubles me about Iraq is that our reason for being there has changed. If you remember, we went in the first place, and we can have our arguments as to whether that was right or wrong, because of the failure of Saddam Hussein to comply with international peace under the United Nations resolution. When we got there, we said that the reconstruction was to create democracy in Iraq. We had no plans to do so, as a result of which we have largely presided over the chaos that we see at the moment. But the reason has changed further. And the other day I heard our Prime Minister here saying that he was there now to defeat terrorism. And I think I said in the last debate I took part in, it is ironic that when we went into Iraq there was no terrorism. But that we had created a security vacuum largely by dismantling the police and the army and the administration, into which the terrorists came willingly. Now there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before we went there, now there is. So in a sense we are there now trying to deal with the situation we ourselves created. And I don't believe that that is any longer viable. So what should we be doing? Again, and I pick up what His Royal Highness said, I think we have to look at the best forms of dialogue that we can achieve. And in that area, regional dialogue must be the solution. And that must include Iran, it must include Syria, I believe it must include Turkey, I think it should include Saudi Arabia and Jordan, and indeed others of the Gulf states as well. Because it is only by identifying the common interests within that region, and there are common interests in creating stability, that at the end of the day you're going to find a means of stabilising the situation in Iraq. So I very much support the concept of getting out of Iraq as fast as you can in military terms, but helping to encourage as far as you can as well that dialogue of the region, which in the end I think can provide at last a stable solution to Iraq. Thank you very much.
Jonathan Friedland, are you going to quarrel with any of your preceding speakers?
Well, I wouldn't mean to, but you said you did, so I may, in a really small way. I think this question does come down in a way to how you view mediation and what you, how you see it. And I think the problem for many of the governments we're talking about, and I think particularly in the case of the Israel-Palestine conflict, both the United States and Israel, is to see mediation as a reward for some kind of change that's happened. You are allowed into the process once you have changed, rather than seeing it as a tool, a process by which people can change. And here I think the Northern Ireland example, which Michael Anklund was involved, at the absolute front line, and which I've reported on from the outside, is really instructive, because last week we saw Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland elected on a democratic mandate, having more or less abandoned all of the positions that made it a pariah party before. I would say that is the fruit of that organisation having been involved in a process one way or the other for nearly 13 years, and they've changed on the way. In other words, if you'd asked them in 1994 to sign up for the things they sign up for now, and say to them, you cannot come to the table until you've agreed to these things, you'd have been nowhere, and in fact we were nowhere for a long time because that was the demand. Instead, the act of being around the table and in negotiation changed the character of the organisation. If you begin to see it that way, then you don't any longer need to say to Iran or Syria or Hamas or Hezbollah, any of the parties that my banker mentioned, you have to change before you can come to the table. You instead believe the act of sitting around the table will bring about that change. That said, and this is my one little bit of disagreement, it is easy, I think, for particularly British politicians and others to say this, because in the Northern Ireland case, when the whole process really got going, 1994, Sinn Féin were on a ceasefire. The crucial change had happened. And Hamas are currently on a ceasefire, but Hezbollah obviously is still in a warlike posture, and we know that Iran and Syria. So I think it is just easier, it was easier for the British government to make that move towards the Republicans in Northern Ireland than it is in the Middle East conflict. Overall, though, I agree, you have to say the dropping of preconditions is the only way you get progress, and then you hope the party sitting opposite you on the table changes. The two that have come up from the distinguished previous speakers are the Iraq case and the Israel-Palestine case. So I'll stick to those. On the Iraq one, I absolutely agree with Michael Anklund. There must be no limits on mediation. Everybody's got to come into this. And the reason why I say that is because of the picture partly painted by Prince Hassan, which is of absolute chaos and collapse and failure and disaster. Those migration statistics, actually that's far too soft a word, those refugee statistics, are just one part of the picture of tremendous damage and calamity that has struck that country as a result of the 2003 invasion. So the first move, I think, has to be an admission that when the United States says to Iran and Syria, yes, we're ready to talk, that has to be understood as an admission of failure. That the policy was actually, the doctrine was, unilateralism. We will do all of this ourselves alone. And to reach out and say, no, actually, we now realise we cannot do anything unless our hated enemies, actors of evil countries like Iran and Syria help us, is an admission that this unilateralist doctrine failed, and failed in the most spectacular way, because it led to this war, calamity, but also, now that the mess has been created by unilateralism, it cannot be got out of unilaterally, others have to pile in and help. So I think this is important, because we're hoping, I can't presume anything, I'm hoping for a change in administration in the United States, but first the country and the elite of the United States have to recognise that this doctrine failed, and must never be repeated. Then there is an interesting question, which is the US, is ready to stick around the table with Iran and Syria? Is it? Who holds the ring? Who chairs both this conversation? The United States' assumption is that it will be there. But if they are a party to these thought, they have to just be a party to them. And I think this is the interesting situation we've got into in terms of geopolitics now, which is who holds the ring? It cannot be the United Nations, they've been so weakened and destabilised, or rather not cannot, they are not at the moment, but perhaps one day they could be so weakened in part by the Iraq adventure. But you have we're in a worst of both world situation, I fear, where the US is simultaneously not so powerful that it can do everything alone as it wanted to under unilateralism, and yet not weak enough that it accepts sitting around the table as just one party among several others. And that tension, this sort of state of limbo, where it needs help of others but cannot bring itself to sit down as an equal, I think is a tremendous problem. Moreover, the United States has abandoned a role, which some would say it never had actually, but of being the honest broker. We're going to get on to Israel Palestine in a minute. But there was a time when you could see the United States, especially post collapse of the Soviet Union, as the sole hyperpower and therefore as a kind of honest broker. To be the honest broker for the kind of huge process, as Royal Highness was saying, was needed, and I agree with him, for the whole region. You would have to have a statement from the United States equivalent to, and Michael Ancon will correct me, I think it was a Northern Ireland Secretary of the Conservative government who made the famous no selfish interest speech, in which the Northern Ireland Secretary of the British government said, we have no selfish strategic interest. I think that was the phrase, in Northern Ireland. That was a huge moment because it said, in other words, we can play umpire, we can be referee between these competing parties, because we, the British government, don't have a territorial or strategic claim. I think that you need the United States, if it is to be the only hyperpower, to make an equivalent statement. Say, we don't have a dog in this hunt, to use Texan for a moment, and to say that we're happy to let the people sit around it, we'll share, and we have our own, substitutes. For that to happen, there would have to be a huge change in energy dependence, and George Bush would have to honour his pledge to wean the country from its addiction to oil. So I am aware this is a huge shift, and I shouldn't hold my breath waiting for this declaration that the United States has no selfish strategic interest. Narrowly on the Israel-Palestine case, because we've only got a minute, I think mediation is essential. The two parties tried doing it themselves for years, actually, and I think it's a good image that one Israeli politician describes the Camp David process as the two parties almost like gymnasts bending over backwards to try and touch each other, and they got about that close that they just couldn't bend any further and stay acceptable to their own electorate, and so that they were ended up in a contortion and collapse. That was tried and failed, so the response to that on the Israeli side was okay, we'll do this unilaterally, we'll withdraw ourselves, no negotiation. That failed, witness the Lebanon conflict of 2006 and the violence continuing in Gaza. So we're back to square one. We've tried negotiation, that didn't work. We'll try unilateralism, that didn't work. What else is left? It has to be some kind of external mediation. The international community has to get involved in this. I think the Arab League peace plan of 2002 is the starting point. It's encouraging that Prime Minister Olmert is finally speaking about that plan and saying there's positive elements in it. Nevertheless, that, and one element I was really pleased to see the Prince mention the international protectorate idea, because I think that is an idea that we need to think of perhaps again. The resistance, of course, you get is on the Israeli side, who are suspicious of mediation. They feel it's outside meddling from people hostile. The only people they accept it from are the United States. The United States are not going to put pressure on Israel to do that until there is a change of administration there. So once again, in both fronts, they end up in the same places, which is we desperately need to change in Washington, and then all these different things can happen.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like, if I may, to come back quickly to Prince Hassan, because the other two, Michael Ancrum and Jonathan Friedland, have actually given us their theories on who should come to the table. I wonder, Your Royal Highness, if you could tell us from your infinitely greater knowledge of the region, how the United States would be regarded as convener, and what your advice would be on the basis of your own experience in conflict mediation or dialogue as to how to get people productively talking to each other.
Michael mentioned a very important point, and that is that the coordinator of such a meeting should be acceptable to the parties. I recall a conversation which has become part of the mythology in Baghdad today. Bremer, if you forgive me to omit the title, contacts Sistani via an intermediary and says, shall we discuss the future of the Iraqi people? And Sistani's intermediary goes back and says, I am born in Persia, you are an American, who are we to discuss the future of the Iraqi people? So I think that as far as the example I have of the Good Friday Agreement, I'll never forget Mo Mollem, all the rights of Knock, Rabbi René Siras, South African and Yugoslav, former Yugoslav official, coming to Jordan. I took them to a Palestinian refugee camp, and we sat in a cafe. And the Palestinian said, what are you? English. Oh, we hate the English because you repressed us. What are you? Oh, you're Irish. We like the Irish because you were repressed by the English as we were. What are you? Israeli. Oh, you know, I'm sort of forgetting Jewish. You know what we do to you if it weren't for the prince being here today. Within 45 minutes, these people who had the experience of conflict resolution were talking to each other and joking. I took Rabbi Sirat, who was born in Annaba, Algeria, into a Palestinian school, and he said, I left at the age of 14. I was refugee, and one of the boys said, Ya Haram, you call poor man. And the rabbi actually wept. I said to him, why are you so emotionally taken aback? He said, because I assumed they would all hate me. I said, well, they've never seen a rabbi before. And as far as the question of Hamas is concerned, I honestly do think that the proposal of the Hudna was never really taken very seriously. I was involved at one stage in contributing to saving the life of one Khalid Mishal and bringing Sheikh Yassin out of Gaza. I think the moment has come where we have to recognize the World Bank says if there is no dialogue, if the government doesn't function, it will collapse and the PA will collapse. So 100 million from 300 million taxes raised from the Palestinian people to be bequeathed by the Prime Minister of Israel, as though it was his to bequeath, to Mahmoud Abbas, at least 200 million, but Kevin Kennedy is talking about 450 million. So the idea of the protection, I think, is an extremely attractive one, simply because it could bring about an international commitment. And again, I think American intervention is hugely important as a guarantor of the success of the exercise to focus on the existential needs of these people. If we don't realize by now that by sins of omission, we have handed over the reins of power and influence in the streets to the populist Islamists, and we're probably going to continue to hand them over further, particularly if a strike also did take place in the next few months. I feel as though we're on a runaway train at times. That there will be a solidarity between Islamists from at least the Nile to the Brahmaputra, I think that we're missing the point. So I do think that dialogue is not necessarily a qualifying step to be taken after an expression of goodwill. I think that expression of goodwill has taken place. I don't think that the meeting in Mecca is viewed as an isolated attempt. It is viewed as an attempt to bring about reconciliation favored by the international community and primarily the United States.
Thank you very much. I wonder if I could invite some comments and questions from the floor, and it would be very nice if you would project your voice and say who you are before you ask.
Thank you very much for the informative things here. I would like to draw the attention that concerning the limits of mediation, I think one of the important topics is, and it's important especially in the European world, is to draw a distinction between what is called the legitimate resistance of people under occupation and terrorists. This distinction is not made. I'm not so familiar about what the American administration does or what Israel do, because essentially Americans are more pragmatic than Europeans, and they follow their interests. So it's not even important. While Europeans are always trying to color their position with a set of values, ethical values, democratic values, religious values, whatever. And because they color their position with values, it means they have to do a distinction between legitimate resistance and people under occupation and terrorism. If you don't do that, then even a young man trying to fight occupation, whatever he does, whether against a soldier, like kidnapping the famous Israeli soldier, which is a military operation against forces of occupation.
And what is it? Could you tell us exactly what you recommend?
If you don't draw this distinct line, then basically you cannot have a majority for the mediation and try to isolate the so-called terrorists, those who kill civilians or those who kill innocents, in order to drive them into becoming a small minority that will act so that they ask themselves to join the negotiation. Basically, we will always have a majority of people against the mediation as a whole.
Okay.
This distinction and definition of terrorism is extremely
Thank you very much. So in other words, there are some terrorists you wouldn't talk to, but there are a lot of people called terrorists that you would.
But you need to bring Al-Qaeda to become something like 0.5% of the population.
Who decides who those, what those are?
Well, that's what I'm coming on to.
Excellent.
Which is that at the same time, conveniently, Al-Qaeda is not an organization and applying the term Al-Qaeda in the original sense and not in an all-purpose sense to any manifestation of life. As it were, have some sympathy with Osama bin Laden. As the organization growing up in Afghanistan, Pakistan, for it, with them I see no ground on which to suggest anything or discussion. If it is so, then it seems to me it's extremely important and not merely a matter of semantics that the political leadership should speak forward about international terrorism as inclusive of Hamas and Hezbollah and if you like the Chechen rebels themselves in a way which as it were commits us to a perpetual war against the international terrorism undefined that we put beyond the bounds of any sort of political dialogue. A lot of people who are on the spectrum between national liberation movements and terrorist activities and methods.
Thank you.
That's my
proposition. And we will come back to the panel. I'll take one more. There was one centre. Yes, you've got your hand up. Yes.
Well, thank you very much for the question. My first question to you from the government is the situation in Syria on its process. Would you say anything in that kingdom to be on its process? And my second question is...
Would you?
Would you say...
No, but would you? And I turned it round on you because it sounded a bit loaded to me, but go on. Okay, you now know that you asked a question at your peril, I might have a go back at you. Johnson, can you respond to these 2 points? Do we need a different definition of terrorism and war on terrorism in order to talk to the people that we need to talk to? And could Britain be the one that mediates?
Well, on the last bit first, I'm pessimistic on that, I'm afraid. I think Britain is so tainted by the Iraq adventure that I can't see it getting a credible hearing in the capitals we're talking about until there is a change, until the troops are gone and a decent interval has passed. I think that's a cause of great regret, but I think it's one of the reasons why I think the current Prime Minister is deluded when he sees himself as an intermediary from the Middle East, because he is refused to resent it for his shoulder-to-shoulder alliance in the invasion of Iraq. So I'm pessimistic on that. On the definition of terrorism thing, I think in a way your two contributions both reveal the problem with it, because you both said there could be a different definition, and your definitions were different from each other. Because if the definition was simply, I think, as the Syrian ambassador was suggesting, terrorists could simply kill civilians, and other people do other things, for example, soldiers or something else, I would journalistically operate that definition myself. The problem with that is that some of the organisations mentioned, Hamas and others, are precisely ostracised because they have in the past killed civilians. If their operations were confined to the abduction of soldiers, killing soldiers, or even including actually settlers, I think the world actually would be different. Hamas and Hezbollah both. I'll just finish my point, because I want to complete what Roger said. The point is that both Hamas and Hezbollah have killed civilians in the past, and therefore, in a way, you can't find a nice, neat, logical line which puts Hamas and Hezbollah on one side and Al-Qaeda on the other. Unless the line becomes, well, we kind of sympathise with what they're about and don't understand what this lot are about. That's not a good enough. So, in a way, the answer might be turned back to some of those groups and say, confine yourself to the killing of soldiers and settlers and actions against occupation. And you actually will find, and this is true even in the Israeli political discourse, those groups who do that and operations like that are actually not subject to the same kind of anger and ostracism as those groups that kill civilians. So I completely agree it was a mistake to talk about a war on terror, a war on an abstract noun, a very, very bad idea. It should have been a war against Al-Qaeda. I completely agree with that. But it's very hard to put a clear line between them just by using this definition of who kills civilians and who doesn't, even though, to my mind, that is the right way to use the word. If somebody who doesn't kill terrorists, kill civilians, in my view, is not a terrorist.
Brinthausen and then Michael Ancrum, any thoughts on this business of how you define terrorism?
Well, I would go back to Boaz Ganor at the Health Clear Institute, who very bravely said no prohibition without definition. So I agree with all of you who agree to the point being made here that, for example, if you were to bring in the Iraqi resistance in the context of the national dialogue, you would obviously be bringing in representatives, and this has been attempted, but without much success, it would appear, to the conflict in Iraq, and you would reassure the Sunni of their position in Iraq, what CNN so fondly refers to as the Sunni Muslims. I describe myself as a cloudy Muslim. So much for cultural affinity. As far as the unilateral approach, I think that what we're suffering from is the uninational approach. And from uninational you move to binational. I have to pull Jonathan's leg in terms of the American-Israeli relationship. That's a binational approach, it's not a bilateral approach. And that's what I think worries all of us in the region, that somehow bringing Syria, Turkey, Iran into the security structure is prohibited by an inability to recognize that if you want to contain spoiling factors, as Michael Ancon said, you have to contain by dialogue. And the last point I would make, Madrid conference, I would go back to that profession of national dialogue. You have to feel good with yourself in your own country, first of all. Then regional dialogue, then international dialogue. But if the international dialogue is just to make lofty statements, as in the case of Madrid or Oslo, then we see what happened to them.
Thank you, Martin.
The definition of terrorism, I think, is a very difficult one. I seem to remember there was a long debate in the United Nations when they were putting forward their review of the future of such the United Nations on whether one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. And you can spend literally hours discussing that and get nowhere. I like to think that, and this is why I go back to what I was saying about explosive dialogue, that you don't have to ask that question to begin the dialogue. Jonathan was partially right in saying we only entered dialogue after the ceasefire. We only entered open and formal dialogue after the ceasefire, but we had, including at the time when the quotation he gave from Peter Brook about no Scottish interest, been in communication during some of the most difficult times of the process, which seems to be remember. And I remember that after the famous message came from the IRA saying the war is over, help us to end it, we were in communication while three sets of bombs went off on the mainland in the country. And we kept going because the dialogue we were having with Scotland, we were not committing ourselves. Now, I think it is terribly important because I quite understand why at the moment, when I was in Jerusalem the other day, Israel says we can't talk to these people, they are actually threatening our people, they're killing our civilians. And I wouldn't expect them at this stage to do so. But it doesn't, it isn't a betrayal of the Israeli interest for others to do so, as long as it's on a historical basis and not trying to commit situations which the Israelis would then find impossible to accept. I do believe this is about to start in a very small way. Madrid was mentioned, Dayton, Ohio, I think the number of the great one building and different rooms in it. But my experience is sometimes you've got to start separately with a different party over a period of time.
But who's you? Who's doing the talking in that case?
I think this is a very good argument. I mean, I actually think the British, in some respects, at the moment are well placed to do it, partly because we know how to. And secondly, because as somebody said to me out there the other day, we don't like this, but at least you do understand this issue because you've been here for a very long time.
Okay, Baroness Simon. And then the
Well, I think on your second question that the Stalinist repatriation of large numbers of people he didn't like around the Black Sea and different parts of the former Soviet Empire didn't actually stabilize the situation. And refugees have a knack of upsetting the status quo. And I think that's quite likely to happen in Jordan as it is in other countries. In Syria, I can't speak for Syria, but I mean, this is an extremely difficult argument to follow. I think that the federalist, decentralized Iraq is a filler model for the rest of the region. There is still that hope we have to cling on to and recognize that the sectarian and ethnic mosaic created in the region, if you listen to the Orthodox Jewish world, they say, well, we will turn the sword into plowshares once we have destroyed all our eastern neighbors. Well, it's very generous of them. I mean, you know, I've used the term turning swords into plowshares in spending $8 billion on turning the industries of the former Soviet Union through the NGO into something else. But to actually posit this as the fruit of victory, I think it is nothing short of insane in today's world. So I really think that anyone who believes they will become a dominating minority and a mosaic of minorities, of whichever ideology, you have Ahmadinejad on the one side wanting to bring the Mahdi to destroy the enemies of Ahmadinejad and of Islam, as he would put it, and you have the evangelists in the United States bringing the Savior to realize Armageddon in our time, I really don't see how this is going to contribute to the future. As for the Europeans, I think that the Conference for Regional Security, we proposed the CSP in the event of arriving at permanent status quo, it's enshrined in the Jordanian-Israeli peace treaty, requires an initiative urgently from the Arab world to create a regional stability charter. I think that as far as the Arab initiative per se, I think it requires Europeans also to understand and to help in explaining this to the Israeli public. I don't think anyone has gone ahead and actually explained what the Arab initiative really means at the end of the day, apart from the broad brush strokes. And as far as establishing a weapons of mass destruction free zone, I mean, when you have Schultz and Nunn and Kissinger and Kerry, hardly wilting flowers talking about the WMDF there, and you have three senior American generals warning against the new strike, I think this has to be taken seriously, and that's the kind of pressure that you can help relieve as far as the region is concerned. Carl Bildt said when he signed the CSC in the Balkans, he said to me, this is a mission empty pact. I said, in a few years' time, we'll see the difference. And today you have former Balkan countries becoming aspiring to or becoming members of Europe. Mm-hmm. And I don't really see why there should be any difference in our region. The basic question is, do you want to rehabilitate the region, or do you want to continue with private agendas, political agendas, more related to your own domestic scene in the respective European countries than related to stabilizing the Eastern Mediterranean?
Thank you. I want to bring in two more before coming back to the rest of the panel here, and then George.
My name is Mona Panini, and I'm from Australia. Your Royal Highness, thank you very much for your respect for the planet. You talked about the art and the creation of the planet in the past. Arab generation was so active and it was really impossible for it seems to be a bit without the generation of Edwin and Jordan in the past. Now is the contrary. Do you think that the Arab generation has lost the ground in favor of Islamic unity?
Okay.
I think the Islamists are now a force in the region, and they represent significant groups of the population who feel marginalized and excluded. In that sense, I think that most political leaders today are prisoners of their own political system. And by, as I said, by sins of omission, we're handing over power. Power is lying in the street, and we're handing over power to the extremists. And this applies across the board before I'm attacked by the Arab press for having been laissez majesté about Arab leadership. I'm not talking only about Arab leadership. I think that governance in general has unfortunately continued to be co-opted by bilateral visits, in particular by Solana, by Condoleezza Rice and so forth, but none of this actually filters down. It is not appealing to the soul of people who feel betrayed. I would say that the Palestinian people feel betrayed today. I mean, the questioning over the question of the right of return, for example, is one of these issues. So I would suggest that the following are required immediately to ensure a continuation of ceasefire. Shuttle diplomacy at a high political level is required. But I think what is also required, as I said, going back to this idea of protection, is not only border monitoring and framework for prisoner exchanges, which are important developments in themselves, But I do think that the weight of the Muslim world has been a subject of effective diplomacy. I mean, if you get Erdogan and the Shaukat Aziz talking to Ahmadinejad, presumably, and you close the door on them, you have a chance of better results than getting a Javier Solana talking to them. I mean, this is why I say that in terms of cultural affinity, you need national reconciliation, you need regional reconciliation, and you have to ask every player to stand up and be counted to the same template of international standards.
Thank you. I'm going to squeeze 5 minutes into 1 minute. George, you have a question, and then each of the panelists will have a chance to make their closing remarks.
Thank you very much. I've got one question, the 1.5 by now. My first question was about the concept of protection we're all having. Do you think the people of the region will accept protection? And protection from whom, and what sort of protection? The second half question is about the Soviet Union has provided. Which belief does the Soviet Union summit?
Can you wait till you have the
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
Yes.
Jonathan, Michael, then John.
Well, two punctuating points, and the first one is a general one. We said that talk, I think we've agreed, talking is better than not talking. Mediation is only a thing. True. But if you talk and talk and talk and then fail, then you end up in a situation not back to square one, but actually much worse than where you were before. And the Israel-Palestine example is that one where you went through the 90s talking, culminates in failure at Camp David, and then you actually enter the second intifada, and much worse than not talking at all, if anything. So yes, talk, it's all better than war, but if you fail, then the war you get is worse than you imagine. And the second point is, after Baroness Simon's point, about the role for the European Union. My fantasy is that the Middle East, the Israel-Palestine conflict, if it were to be resolved on the same lines as in Northern Ireland, European Union would, alongside the Arab League actually, play the role that the Irish Republic played, Dublin played, in standing behind, if you like, the Palestinians, and the United States would play the role that London and Britain play, standing behind the British. And the two London and the British would play the EU would play the role that Dublin played, standing behind the nationalists in the Northern Ireland Peace Process, and the British would play the role that the United States would play the role the British played, standing behind the Unionists in Northern Ireland. Is that clear? I spat it out. But you need to have these sort of patrons, sponsors behind you who underwrite what you say, encourage you to do it, and occasionally push and prod you to do what you don't want to do. For this to work, these two sponsors standing sort of behind these chairs have to have an understanding with each other. So the EU and the United States would have to have a sense that they share where how they want to see this conflict resolved, just as actually London and Dublin did in the Northern Ireland process. And the I think all those elements are in place, but it requires huge political will, and each side has to be ready to say difficult things for their own client, if you like. And the European Union would have to be able to say to Palestinians, you know, we can get this far, but no further. And similarly, the United States would have to say that to Israel. I hope that is now not tangled up.
No, that's perfect. Thank you.
My geography is quite confused by Jonathan's... can I just make one comment on that? I think it's important. I don't disagree with the idea of sponsorship, but the history of the Northern Ireland Peace Process was some of the major rows, the biggest rows, we've had reaction between Dublin and London. And rows are actually an important part of the process, because the sponsors are having to argue with each other in terms of the reasons themselves. Europe, I mean, I hope I'm not just putting my slips there. I don't believe there is such a thing as European foreign policy. And I think, particularly in terms of the Middle East, I've been recently to Lebanon, and the French view of what happened there in the summer is very different to the British and other European views. But I think the idea that Europe is suddenly going to come down as a great white mouth and produce a solution just isn't going to happen in practice. And so I think we've got to beware of that. But I would actually be nervous, anyway, of what I call superpowers or blocks drawing lines. There's a very good book written some time ago, I think by a Canadian lady, called Peacemakers. and it was the story of the Versailles Treaty after the First World War. And chapter by chapter showed how three old men in Paris drew lines all around the world and divided the world up according to what they thought was the best thing. In almost every single one of those cases, those lines led to conflict 20, 30 years down the road. And the only solution you ever get at last are those that have popular consent are built from the bottom up of, rather than those imposed from the top down. And I go back to what I was saying, the only way is through that is by dialogue.
I would say in terms of the Sunni Shia, Cold War, as it's been described by Martin Indyk, I mean, I don't know how eminently qualified Martin Indyk is to comment on Sunni Shia relations in the first place, but I have said that separating certain cases by elevating a moral authority of conversation between the four schools of Sunni Islam, Zaydi and Imami Shia schools, and the Ababis, because I think that the only way to delegitimize the Al-Qaeda's, for example, who I regard as deregulators of Islam, because I don't know of any religion that says thou shalt kill civilians, is by developing legitimacy once again of moral authority and dialogue. The Hajj, for example, has become a question of ritual. It is no longer a question of consultation. It may even be a forum for recruiting extremists, but it's certainly not a forum for conversations around the era. I mean, to have an occasional legitimacy of a conference between parties in Mecca so as to solemnly promise not to do the things that they're doing is, and then to see a return to the norm of violence is a tragedy, because there are obviously spoilers out there who are not achieving results. So as far as Najaf is concerned, as far as Jerusalem is concerned, as far as Mecca is concerned, it is absolutely essential to recognize when Kissinger asks what is the address of Europe, I don't know what answer he received, but I would say if you were to ask what is the address, or anyone were to ask what is the address of Islam, Mecca should present itself immediately. If you were to ask what is the address of three monotheistic faiths, I would say that Jerusalem is the case. But as far as the business exchange between the head of state of the Republic of Iran and the head of state of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, or the head of state of the Vatican and the president of secular Turkey are concerned, these are visits between heads of state. They are not actually a discussion of the different approaches of the religious schools. And I think that it's time to talk about putting these people back to doing what they should be doing, and that is countering terrorism and extremism by addressing a cohesion fund for the region, a stability charter for the region. And let me say that in terms of Zakat, for example, I've been asked by American Jewish, Christian and Muslim leaders, would I be prepared to offer my name to a betting agency? I said, well, all I have is my name, but I'm not professionally qualified to run a fund. Maybe your bank can run the fund, or people of high financial integrity could run a fund. But the time has come to address the question of poverty. We need 100 million job opportunities in West Asia, North Africa, according to the World Bank, by 2015, or else we're handing the region over to anarchy. As far as the protectorate is concerned, would they accept it? I think if it was put very clearly that this is the will of the international community, and the 450 million effectively, that's what I'm talking of in terms of protection, would depoliticize the wall. Don't forget that the wall, according to the decision taken by the High Court, including an American judge, the Secretary General was asked to report every quarter on the economic damage done by the wall, on six criteria of economic damage. I don't see that reporting taking place. So there's obviously a missing link in this equation that has to be considered. Secondly, the Israeli-Palestinian fortunes are so intertwined that they both need a respite, I think, from this. And the objectivity of this protectorate is well defined by Tony Klug, KLUG, in the Oxford Research Group's most recent study, and I strongly recommend that you read it. Lastly, I want to say that unfortunately all our policies are military-led. I say this in the presence of Field Marshal Ilse, Field Marshal Ilse, and I refer here to this wonderful document The capstone concept for joint operations.
Which I have read.
Which I have to read because I've been invited to speak at Annapolis and the American Defense College in a few weeks' time. I don't know why they want to invite me, but anyway. I'm glad to
say, I
might know something about the region, that's just about all I can bring to the table. But they do say, and I quote, and I thought this is rather a good way to end, the joint force must maintain an unsurpassed ability to fight and win the nation's wars. My question is, what about winning the peace? And it goes on to say, however, it must recognize the national security implications of operations that do not necessarily include either adversaries or combat. General Petraeus is saying we can't win wars by military means alone. And it adds examples include peacekeeping, humanitarian relief operations, and support to civil authorities, both foreign and domestic. So there's a window of opportunity.
I want to thank all our panelists. I think, Pentathlon, you have gracious for a lot of your time and a lot of your insights, and been incredibly polite in doing so, if I may say so. I don't think there is a job for Britain in that mix. I couldn't find one in everything that you said. And I thank Michael Ancrum and Duncan Friedland as well, of course, for engaging us with their thoughts and with their experience from Northern Ireland, which was made very relevant to the Conservatives.
I hope you'll invite us back to another round to discuss Britain's role.
Yes.
Past, present and future.
Thank you. Thank you.